Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/ladykillers. With over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. And for all of you listeners out there of the Lady Killers podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. I just actually finished listening to the unabridged version of The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien. And, you know, that's a book I've read probably 20 times in my life, and it's even better than it ever was listening to it as an audio file. You know, I was on a road trip, and it really just, it swept me away, put me into that story, and I felt like I was on a journey with one of those characters. So, you know, maybe you're not into fantasy, though, and you just want a thriller that'll go along with your serial killer podcast. So there's The Girl on the Train, which is a good option. So check it out, you know. It's all entirely up to you. To download your free audiobook today, go to audibletrial.com/ladykillers. Again, that's audibletrial.com/ladykillers for your free audiobook. Welcome to Lady Killers, a podcast about female serial killers. I am your host, Abraham Archambault. Let's go dig up some bodies. I hope this podcast finds you all doing well. I'm doing okay, but the weather has taken a cold turn up here in the Pacific Northwest. You can tell the winter is on its way, and we're all trying to stay as warm as we possibly can up here, and hopefully all you guys out there are doing the same. Maybe you can all just cozy up next to the fire, read my screenplay, Loon Lake, which is available for purchase on Amazon as we speak. Since you brought up Loon Lake, the latest biggest news on that is that I tentatively have secured a lead actor for the role of Michael in Loon Lake. I'm not releasing any names just yet until I have everything completely finalized, but I feel it's a perfect choice for Michael. I couldn't have found a better person. And another great thing about it is that it puts us one step closer to actually seeing Loon Lake up on the big screen next year. So I'll let you all know as soon as it's final. You guys will be the first to know. So that's the news for the week about Loon Lake. Let's get on with the podcast. And I do want to warn you that the episode for this week, as in every other week, contains explicit material, a lot of talk of murder. So you have been warned. So getting on with Lady Killers. If you are unfamiliar with this podcast, if this is your first episode that you're listening to, Lady Killers, it's a podcast about female serial killers, since we always hear way too much about the men that are serial killers. I think we need to see some of the crazy women that are out there as well. Every episode, we will pick a female serial killer from a different state in the United States each week until we make our way through the entire country. And the Lady Killer for this week, she did all of her heinous deeds in the state of Massachusetts. So for all of you out there from Massachusetts, this one's for you. Many people claim that she's the first serial killer in the United States. And it's probably true as far as the amount of deaths that surrounded her. It's definitely a possibility. But come along with me. We're hopping in the Wayback Machine today, folks. Let's jump in and talk about the atrocious Jane Toppin. Jane Toppin was born Honora Kelly on March 31st, 1854 in Boston, Massachusetts, to poor Irish immigrants Peter and Bridget Kelly. Now, from this point on, I'm just going to refer to her as Jane. that wasn't her birth name. It ended up being an adopted name that she picked up along the way. But from this point on, I'm just going to go ahead and refer to her as Jane, just to avoid any confusion. So going to Jane, not very many records survived for Toppin's early years. Anything that did survive really does paint an ugly picture for her, and possibly, you know, what her future would bring. Her mother, Bridget, she died of tuberculosis when Jane was very young. So she really didn't have a positive female role model in her life. Her father, Peter, he was a well-known eccentric alcoholic around town. He was extremely abusive, and he actually earned the nickname Kelly the Crack, as in crackpot, around town. And it was just due to all the rumors that were spreading around town about Peter, his insanity, his madness. And one of the most popular and sadistic rumors about Peter, his insanity pushed him so far that he was a tailor. That was his job, his trade. But during one day of sewing some clothes, he decided he wanted to sew his own eyelid shut. So he did this, and that's how he was found. And from that point on, he would live in an asylum for the rest of his life. So that's just one little tidbit there. So once we find out what Jane Toppin actually did here, it's not going to be any surprise that the same blood of Peter Kelly ran through Jane's veins. After the death, in 1863, a few years after his wife's death, Peter Kelly took his two youngest children, 8-year-old Delia and 6-year-old Jane, to the Boston Female Asylum. This was an orphanage, basically is what they used to call them, for indigent female children. He didn't give any reason why he was bringing the children to transfer them to the orphanage, but some of the documents from the asylum had notes that stated these girls were, quote, rescued from a very miserable home. And I'm not shocked at all, and I don't think any of you out there should be shocked. You know, he was a raging and abusive alcoholic, and he likes to sew his eyelids shut. I don't think anybody should be surprised that he was unable to raise his daughters on his own. It turns out that the Boston Female Asylum, it was not a vacation spot for those two girls either. Weren't a lot of written records of the girls' experiences inside the asylum, but it is known that not too long after arriving at the asylum, Jane's sister Delia became a sex worker. Now, here's where it gets a little tricky, because I found conflicting reports about how old she was at the time she became the sex worker. It was anywhere between the ages of maybe 8 up to even 12, I saw at some points, but I don't think that really matters the age. I mean, a 10-year-old becoming a sex worker, it's completely disgusting, and it's a sign of how disgusting it was at that time. There was also an older sister named Nellie. She did not join them at the Boston Female Asylum, but she was committed to a different asylum, which it ended up being the same asylum that their father was committed to as well. And so Nellie, she would live her entire life in that asylum, no future at all. And then there was also, you know, the future was not too bright for Delia and Jane either. But anyway, let's get back to Jane. A little less than 2 years after her father dropped her off at the asylum, little Jane was placed as an indentured servant in the home of Mr. Abner Toppin and his wife Anne of Lowell, Massachusetts. So you have three sisters, all of them torn apart from one another and sent to be, one, a prostitute, two, an indentured servant, which we'll just go ahead and call her a slave, and three, one that was locked away forever in an asylum due to her insanity. It's a good thing, because she probably locked away before she could sew her own eyelids shut or something even worse than that. So Jane was adopted by the Toppin family, and she assumed the surname of Toppin, as I mentioned earlier. And so she went by Jane Toppin, and she lived as one of them. It was said she got along very, very well. And Elizabeth was her foster sister. She was said to be very, very pretty, but they were all very privileged. And, you know, they already had a daughter, and Elizabeth didn't need some other girl coming into their life, mixing things up. So she, you know, I don't think she wasn't a very good sister to Jane. She treated her pretty horribly. While Jane was there, she would see how, you know, people with money were treated, how they lived, and she really wanted that so much for her life. So she excelled during her school years, and you know, it seemed as though there was some promise for her future, like she was actually going to come out of this okay, unlike her sisters. You know, maybe she was going to be just one that would actually succeed and live a normal life. And apparently, you know, it was said that all she ever wanted was to just meet a rich man who cared deeply for her, who wanted to take care of her, who would whisk her away and marry her. She already had a problem with trusting people, and that distrust would grow even more when she was left at the altar at the age of 19. So she thought she was getting married. She thought this rich man was actually going to fulfill her fantasy and whisk her away to where she would live happily ever after. But all those previous hopes of being whisked away by her knight in shining armor were instantly dashed in that moment where she was left at the altar. This would also be the beginning of her descent into madness. Shortly after, she attempted suicide, and it wasn't just one occasion. She attempted it pretty frequently. She was crying out for something, that's for sure. Apparently, she also had a period of very strange behavior where she became obsessed with people and their dreams. Somehow, she got it into her mind that she could analyze people's dreams and that those dreams actually could predict the future. So she's diving into some interesting things here. She thought she could analyze people's dreams and predict the future. I wonder if she saw all the bodies that she left in her wake during an analysis of her own dreams. I don't know if she did that. Just something I like to think about. So after a few years of this odd behavior, and after all of her suicide attempts, kind of seemed like Jane was starting to come around and level off a little bit and start to live a normal life. She was actually accepted as a nursing student in 1885 at a Cambridge hospital. And once again, just like in grade school and high school, she excelled in all of her studies. And it appeared everybody loved her. She was bright and bubbly. She was just a great student, and she quickly earned the nickname Jolly Jane, because she was so happy and bubbly everywhere she went. But there was one thing that raised some red flags with her supervisors and some of her other colleagues. She was obsessed with autopsies. In 1889, Jane was referred to and accepted by Massachusetts General Hospital, which was a prestigious hospital in the region where everyone wanted to work. That's where all the nurses wanted to be and the doctors. And she was accepted for her exceptional nursing skills. And this was going to be a great opportunity for her to learn from the best and to further her nursing education and her career. And while there, that's when her reckless administering of opiates, it led to the death of at least two of her patients that the staff knew about. And so she was let go at that time. Jane Toppin returned to Cambridge, and she resumed her role as a nurse there. And so things started to progress normally for a stretch until two more patients were found dead while under Jane's care. The deaths were deemed mysterious, and so they let Jane go without her achieving her certificate as a nurse. But that wouldn't be a problem for Jane because she found a good workaround. She found work as a private nurse, and this was where she would make either house calls to private homes, or she would be a live-in nurse for a lot of older people that were sick and dying. She didn't have her nursing certificate, but that was something she just forged. Any of the necessary paperwork that were needed for her employment, she forged them. So it was no big deal for her. And she actually would work in this fashion for the next two decades without incident. Before we leave the hospital in Cambridge, I should point out a few things that Jane did. In my opinion, these were some huge red flags. It's definitely something that would never happen today. You know, she loved to experiment with her patients. She would administer various drugs, mostly morphine and atropine. She would alter the dosages to see what the effects on the patients would be. So they're essentially these old dying people were Jane's guinea pigs for different opiates to see what the reactions, she wanted to see what it did to their nervous systems. And on many occasions, she would administer the drugs, and then she would climb into the bed with the patients as they drifted in and out of consciousness. When she was arrested later on, she said she used to do this because she wanted to be as close to them as possible as they neared their death. And then she wanted to bring them back from the brink of death, hold them close to her as they approached death once again. And then I never found out if she actually practiced any sexual activity with the patients. There was no proof that was found, but authorities heard her saying at one time that she did achieve some sort of sexual thrill by conducting these experiments, which is pretty interesting. She got off, actually, by trying to play God. You know, she would bring them to the brink of death, and then she would save them, and then she would take them back to the brink of death, and so forth and so on. She would go back and forth till they finally expired there in the bed as she held them in her arms. You know, this just goes to show the differences in the serial killers from back then and what you would compare today. Today, you know, all statistics show that not very many women kill for sexual satisfaction. It's all for monetary gain or some sort of revenge. So, you know, this was Jane Toppin was definitely a first in many things that she was doing at the time. But at any rate, Jane would continue to practice as a private nurse throughout New England, assisting elderly patients who couldn't help themselves. And that went on for about 5 years without anything happening. The only thing that really stood out about Jane's time up to this point is that many of the homeowners would complain that she was a thief. Just petty thief is what they called her. Apparently she would steal a little bit of this, a little bit of that from different homes, but nothing really large enough to warrant any charges to be brought up against her. So that's what she would do. Little trinkets and stuff she would steal out of the homes. Nothing too serious. But aside from those petty thefts, it seemed as though Jane had found a purpose in her life to help and assist dying elderly patients. All was well until 1895, when Jane began her notorious poisoning spree. Her landlord, Israel Dunham, and his wife, Lovely, were her first victims. Now, I should say her first known victims, because after we're done with this, you'll see that she probably started a lot longer before this, but as far as when she kind of dropped onto people's radars, it was her landlord, Israel Dunham, and his wife, Lovely. So after they died, she waited another few years and decided she was going to return to her foster sister, the Toppin family, and find Elizabeth. And she finally found her, and she dosed her with strychnine in 1899. Now, strychnine, for those of you who don't know what it is, was commonly used in pesticides back then, and it was used to kill small birds and animals, most notably rats. So when you hear strychnine, you think rat poisoning. So that's exactly what she did when she paid Elizabeth a visit. This was seen as a revenge killing for probably things that happened back in the Toppin family home when she was younger. After they adopted her, Elizabeth probably was not a great sister, especially since things were already going a certain way in her family, and then here comes Jane to mix everything up. Not much was written about that murder of Elizabeth, but I mean, it was a revenge killing. Obviously, for the way Elizabeth treated Jane, she was basically a slave in that house. She had to do whatever they told her to do and just watch all these rich people, you know, do whatever they want. I guess payback really is a cold bitch in this case. Normally, jolly old Jane Toppin would kill her patients with various opiates while they wasted away in their hospital beds. They all had real sicknesses and diseases that would mask Jane's murderous intent, so nobody really thought anything when they did die, since they were already knocking on death's door when Jane came into contact with them. So it was just seen as her basically helping people into death, pain-free is what it seems like. They didn't raise much suspicion. They were helpless victims, basically. So this taste for blood with her landlords and her ex-foster sister, it was a newly found outlet for her murderous ways. I don't think she was no longer sated with killing those who already had a death sentence in their hospital beds. She needed live people, young, virile people that maybe she could take care of. So that was another thought going through her mind. In 1901, Jane Toppin moved to Calumet. I hope I am pronouncing that correctly for all you Massachusetts natives out there. Calumet, 1901, she moved in with an elderly man by the name of Alden Davis and the rest of his family. They were seeking assistance because Alden's wife, Maddie, had died recently, and he needed someone to look after the house and help take care of him. Now, an interesting fact that I found out about Maddie, Alden Davis's wife, was actually murdered by Jolly Jane just a month earlier. And so this was the main reason that Jane moved in with the Davis family anyway, was to help them get over the death of Maddie. So Jane moved in, and within a couple of weeks, she killed Alden Davis. Now, along with Mr. Davis, she decided to murder his daughters, Genevieve, who went by the name of Annie, and Minnie, who went by the name of Mary. All of those victims were administered shots of morphine and atropine by Jane Toppin at some point in her duties as nurse in that house. And so she had officially graduated into murdering non-hospitalized victims, victims that actually didn't even have death already looming over their heads. She just chose new victims. After finishing off most of the Davis household, Jolly Jane returned to her hometown, where she planned to murder another old foster sister of hers named Edna. And the plan there was to kill Edna, get her back for whatever wrongdoings happened during her childhood, and then steal her husband away. And, you know, I gotta hand it to Jolly Jane here. She never forgot about being wronged by all the different people that she came across throughout her troubled life. She held some serious grudges, and she followed through with her own twisted vengeance. She succeeded in murdering Edna, and she immediately began courting her foster sister's widower. She actually poisoned him, and she tried to nurse him back to health. And this would show that, you know, she was trying to prove her worth and make him fall in love with this amazing angel. She even went as far as taking the poison herself to evoke some sympathy, make it look like she was sick along with him. But he caught on to her plan pretty quickly, and he ousted her from his home. Now, some suspicions were definitely raised by the remaining members of the Davis family back in Calumet. The surviving members ordered toxicology exams on Alden, who supposedly he had died from a stroke. But they ordered toxicology exams for him and for the youngest daughter, Minnie. These reports came out, and they found out that Minnie had indeed been poisoned with lethal doses of morphine. So the local police, they put out a detail to find this Jane Toppin, but she had already fled the Davis house, and she presumably left the entire Boston area. On October 29th, 1901, the authorities finally caught up with Jane Toppin, and she was arrested for murder in, she was in Amherst, New Hampshire at the time, and they got her in, and she originally confessed to killing the members of the Davis family, but she said that wasn't it. She also had 11 other victims fresh on her mind, so she rattled off those names, and at the time of her apprehension, she was already moving on to a new patient. She was nurse to a new patient, probably planning on murdering her as well. So it's a good thing she was caught at that time, because it would have just continued on the way it looks here. By the next year, in 1902, Jane had copped to murdering at least 31 people. Those are just the 31 victims that she could actually come up with their names. Apparently there were many, many more, but she couldn't remember any of the names of them. A lot of the families of the victims, they didn't want to be involved in any of these investigations, because back then they immediately would dig up the body. I don't hear that happening a lot these days, but back then, exhumation of the bodies was huge, to have autopsies performed on these bodies to check for, you know, foul play. Once a body was buried, they wanted to make sure, you know, they didn't want to their body to go through another autopsy. You know, they just wanted to move on into the future and leave the past behind. So many of them would not cooperate in any of the investigations. So an accurate number of victims, I can't quote that. It's not known. All that is known, though, is that she killed 31 victims. But it's said that she probably killed between 70 and 100 people during that reign of terror. During old Jolly Jane's trial, her own lawyer was pushing for an insanity plea. I think they had a pretty good case for this. Just take a look at her family history. You don't have to think about it too hard. I mean, she had her father committed to an asylum. Her older sister was also committed to an asylum. I mean, multiple suicide attempts. It's kind of all just laid out there for her. And I think the insanity deal, I think it was sealed when Jane was quoted as saying, quote, "That is my ambition, to have killed more people, more helpless people, than any man or woman who has ever lived." End quote. You know, as a nurse, Jane Toppin was competent, and she was actually pretty sensitive to her patients' needs. Some of the, you know, the most well-known families in Boston at the time employed her, and she was good at her job as a nurse. She had the patience, she had the bedside manner that was needed in that profession, and the only problem is she was also a very good murderer that none of her employers knew about until after the fact. So, you know, some of them never even found out, and they became victims of Jane Toppin and her needle. The New York Journal at that time, one of William Randolph Hearst's newspapers, he printed Jane's confession, where she claimed the total deaths to be more than 31. It was also printed that she wanted to be found guilty by insanity, because if she was found guilty by the insanity, this might actually give her a chance to be released sometime down the road. But on the contrary, during her trial, she insisted that she was sane the whole time. So we have that those conflicting facts there, you know. It was said that she wanted to plead, you know, that she was sane and that she was guilty, possibly, to be released. And then on the other hand, she's saying she's insane. She couldn't make up her mind whether she wanted people to think she was crazy or not. I think she knew what she was doing. I think she knew what the consequences were going to be by doing the things she was doing. I really don't know what her true intention during the trial was. All I know is that she didn't want to be locked in an asylum. I think she wanted to be back out there as a nurse. She really probably had true intentions as a nurse. It just, you know, her mental capacities were limited. I think she probably was insane, and that got involved and, you know, got all mixed up in her good intentions. And, you know, nevertheless, she was found not guilty by reason of insanity, and she was confined to a state asylum in Taunton, Massachusetts. Again, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly for all you out there. And Taunton is where she would remain for the rest of her life. Many of the orderlies and people that looked after her during her stay in the asylum said she was just a quiet old lady, didn't bother anybody. And she feared that the guards were going to poison her food or her drink, kind of as a payback for all those people that she had killed. Maybe she was looking for sympathy, the same way she did when she tried to woo the widower of her dead ex-foster sister. I don't know. There were also many others in that asylum that kind of contradicted that story. They claimed that she was the same cold and calculated killer in the asylum that she was out in the real world. It was said that she begged some of the guards to let her have some morphine so she could administer her famous shot of death to some of the other patients at the asylum. One orderly in the asylum claimed she once said, quote, "Get some morphine, dearie, and we'll go out in the ward. You and I will have a lot of fun seeing them die," end quote. So even locked away forever, she still had that itch. Jane Toppin would end up dying in August of 1938, at the ripe old age of 84 from natural causes. The angel of death had finally met her own. She never ended up leaving Taunton, and she is buried there in the Mayflower Hill Cemetery in Bristol County. So there you have it, kiddies. Jane Taupin, America's first female serial killer. I hope you enjoyed it. And remember, if you feel the urge, you can always support this podcast by clicking the link in the liner notes for this episode. If not, just enjoy these free weekly episodes. Share them with your friends. Let them know what we have out there. This has been Lady Killers. I am your host, Abraham Archambault. I hope you have sweet dreams.